You are constantly being watched, measured.
Crunched for like every single day.
Right. Every time you open an app or, you know, walk through a city square or just swipe a loyalty card at the grocery store, a data point gets logged.
Yeah, it's relentless.
But how often do you actually feel the weight of that surveillance?
Bah.
Today, we're doing a deep dive into something profoundly human. We're looking at the visceral physical sensation of privacy.
And more importantly, the almost impossible challenge of translating that very subjective, fragile experience into hard technical parameters for artificial intelligence.
Exactly. And our source material today is brilliant. We've got our hands on a graduate-level seminar lecture from the Ethics Workshop. And it completely strips away the abstract theory, you know? It looks at the lived experience of privacy through three very specific real-world case studies.
It does, and it sets up this defining tension of our current technological era right from the start. We are dealing with a fundamental mismatch.
Between humans and systems.
Right. If you think about an algorithm, it operates on teleological data extraction. It's relentlessly goal-oriented. It wants hard metrics to optimize for a specific outcome.
Like serving you the perfect ad.
Exactly. But human privacy isn't a math equation, it's a phenomenological state.
A lived
Or
experience.
feeling, yeah. The challenge for engineers isn't just about, coding secure software or encrypting a database. It's the immense hurdle of mathematically defining the boundary of human dignity. We are basically asking binary code to understand a highly nuanced emotional state.
Which is wild when you actually think about it. And before we really get into the cases, I want you, the listener, to actively consider your own threshold. Where exactly is the line in your own life where a convenience crosses over and becomes an intrusion?
It's a great question to keep in the back of your mind.
Yeah. So let's look at the first case study from this seminar to see how that mismatch plays out. It's about a company called Telly. And this isn't some hypothetical sci-fi scenario. This actually happened.
The television giveaway.
The television giveaway.
Yeah.
Telly manufactured and gave away 500,000 high-end 4K televisions, absolutely free.
But there was one unyielding catch.
Right. To use the TV, you had to leave an illuminated built-in camera turned on the entire time you were in the room watching it.
Which immediately brings that goal-oriented nature of algorithms right into your living room. And the way this camera functions, it's critical to understand this. It doesn't even need a microphone to do its job.
Wait, really? No microphone.
No microphone. It relies entirely on continuous image capture to analyze your identity, your environment, and your activities in real time. It's just constantly scanning. Who is sitting on the couch? What are they doing? Are they looking at the screen?
So it's just watching and making assumptions.
Right. It makes immediate behavioral predictions. The seminar gives this incredibly grounded example. The camera observes you sitting on the sofa eating potato chips. The algorithm recognizes the hand-to-mouth behavior, identifies the bag, and infers a high probability that you are getting thirsty, and instantly deploys a targeted Coca-Cola advertisement right there in the lower right-hand corner of the screen.
That feels almost more invasive than a hot mic. It doesn't need to hear you say you're thirsty. It just watches the mechanics of your behavior.
Yes.
And the philosophical dilemma the lecturer highlights here is just remarkably raw. You are being offered a direct trade-off. You are commodifying your domestic sanctuary.
The ultimate private refuge.
Exactly. The living room is where we go to be unobserved. And you are trading that unobserved self in exchange for a consumer good. You're giving up the sanctuary of your home for 4K resolution.
And what's fascinating is the sociological data point the lecture brings up. When this exact scenario is presented to university students in these seminars, about 25% of them say they would take the deal.
A quarter of the class.
Yeah, but it's what happens right after they say yes that is so revealing. They immediately start negotiating the technical parameters.
They start asking questions.
Right. They ask, are there microphones involved? Or does the camera stay on in an active state if I get up to go to the kitchen? What's the camera's field of view?
Can't see the dining room table.
Exactly. They want to define the physical geometry of the surveillance, draw a box around it.
But both the lecturer and we agree, those technical inquiries are just complete
It's
distractions.
total distraction.
Whether the camera's field of view is 90 degrees or 120 degrees doesn't change the fundamental ethical reality. The core dilemma is the willful acceptance of domestic surveillance. You invited the watcher into your house.
It's a defense mechanism, really. The students are trying to find a technical loophole to preserve a feeling of privacy that they have already bargained away. But the algorithm has no concept of what a sanctuary is. It only cares about the correlation between salty snacks and soda consumption.
Right. It's a machine.
It perfectly highlights how poorly equipped we are to defend an abstract value like privacy when it's weighed against a free, high-end TV.
Okay, so that's the commodification of the private home. But then the seminar pivots to a completely different type of privacy. It takes us out of the living room and into the concept of public intimacy.
The generic intruder.
The generic intruder, yes. And it uses a thought experiment grounded in a historical event. The instant, spur-of-the-moment marriage of Elvis and Priscilla Presley at a Las Vegas wedding chapel.
This shifts the focus in a really crucial way. Think about a wedding. It's a profoundly personal milestone, a celebration of lifelong unity, the first kiss. It's a moment of intense vulnerability and public intimacy.
But there's this friction in the famous photograph from that day. Standing right there in the frame with Elvis and Priscilla is a completely generic, uninvited accordion player.
Just a guy doing his job.
Just guy. Looking perfectly happy, but he has absolutely no personal connection to the couple. Imagine looking at your wedding album years later, and there's just some stranger beaming in the background of your first kiss. He's not doing anything wrong, but he doesn't belong there.
And his presence raises a massive question for academics about contextual integrity. Does the inclusion of an entirely generic observer fundamentally degrade the privacy of the event?
Because privacy isn't just about physical isolation.
Yeah.
If it was Priscilla's mother standing there, it wouldn't feel like a violation at all.
Precisely. Privacy is deeply tied to the specific context and the identity of the observers. The accordion player isn't malicious, but his mere status as a stranger alters the fabric of that private experience.
The lecturer layers in this great personal anecdote to really deepen this dilemma. They recall living in Puerto Rico, right on the beach, and they'd go for a swim in the ocean and then have to walk back to their apartment dripping wet in a swimsuit, carrying a towel.
Right.
And they had to walk past these incredibly elegant, formal beach weddings. And the key detail here is the distance. The lecturer notes they maintained a wide distance, walking many meters away. But even from that distance, they still experienced this lingering, deeply uncomfortable sensation that they were intruding upon and ruining the privacy of the ceremony.
That uncomfortable sensation is exactly what privacy feels like. It's atmospheric. The lecturer wasn't physically interfering, they weren't stepping into the photos, yet their mere presence as a dripping, wet, out-of-context observer disrupted the atmospheric integrity of the event.
So how do we technically define this fragile architecture of intimacy?
That is the ultimate engineering hurdle.
Right. If an uninvited generic presence standing 30 meters away alters the phenomenological state of a wedding, how can an algorithm ever be trained to respect a boundary that is felt rather than physically drawn?
It can't, because the algorithm only measures distance and proximity. It doesn't measure intimacy. It cannot distinguish between the gaze of a loving family member, the awkward glance of a guy in a swimsuit, and the passive data collection of a machine. It strips away the contextual integrity entirely.
Which brings us to the third and final case study, the algorithmic oracle. And honestly, this might be the most chilling one because it deals with predictive capabilities. It's the seminal case in emotion AI ethics, the target pregnancy prediction.
The 15-year-old girl.
Yes. The lecturer notes this case is somewhat apocryphal in its popular retelling, but it is highly illustrative.
What makes this case so striking is the absolute banality of the data collection. The teenager was experiencing very early, subtle physical symptoms of pregnancy. Things like scratchy, dry skin.
Stuff she might not have even recognized as pregnancy yet.
Exactly. So she went to Target and purchased seemingly innocuous items. Anti-itch creams, unscented lotions, cotton balls. And she surrendered this data voluntarily.
Through a store discount card program.
Right. She swiped a loyalty card. And Target's inference engine went to work. It cross-referenced those minor purchases against vast historical client data.
Finding the patterns.
The algorithm deduced her pregnancy long before she or her family had consciously acknowledged it.
And the automated response was just ruthless. Because the algorithm flagged her as pregnant, Target automatically mailed congratulatory coupons for cribs and diapers directly to her house.
And the fallout is a very dark irony grounded in the source material.
Her dad intercepted the mail.
Yes. An enraged father drives to the store, complaining to management that they are encouraging teen pregnancy by sending maternity marketing to his high school daughter, only to subsequently discover, after talking with her, that the algorithm's deduction was entirely accurate.
A retail corporation basically informed a teenager of her own pregnancy.
It is a monumental ethical violation, and we need to analyze why. Target didn't steal the data, it was given voluntarily. But the predictive aggregation bypassed a profound boundary of human agency.
It stole her timeline. It bypassed her fundamental human right to process and disclose a deeply intimate biological truth on her own terms.
The machine stripped away her autonomy. It completely ignored the psychological gravity of the information. To the algorithm, a life-altering human event was just an opportunity to sell a crib.
So tying these three threads together, we get a really clear picture of what privacy actually feels like. It's the creeping loss of sanctuary we saw at the telecamera. It's the atmospheric disruption of a generic observer, like the accordion player or the beachgoer. And it's the stark violation of predictive exposure with target.
And it highlights the immense difficulty of algorithmic alignment. Algorithms parse lotion purchases and image captures. They do not inherently understand the subjective weight of being observed. Defining privacy technically requires coding for human dignity, not just data encryption.
And that is why this deep dive is so relevant to you. Every discount card you use, every smart device you accept, every public space you navigate forces you to negotiate this invisible boundary between personal sensation and algorithmic data collection.
The human experience of privacy is just far more complex and delicate than a terms of service agreement can ever capture.
It really is. And we want to leave you with a final, stark, unresolved ethical dilemma that builds on everything we've discussed today.
As predictive algorithms become capable of seeing deeply into our physical realities, you are forced to make a choice.
If an AI could perfectly predict and prevent a looming public health catastrophe by passively and continually monitoring the most intimate, mundane behaviors inside every citizen's home, do you prioritize the inviolable, subjective sanctuary of personal privacy, or do you surrender it to the utilitarian imperative of collective social well-being? When the survival of the many is on the line, does the private self still have a right to exist unseen?
Something to think about.
Until next time.